Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Cindy Gusak, Executive Director of the Collaboration Center Foundation. The nonprofit organization is hosting its fourth annual Harvesting Hope Family Fall Festival and Community Resource Fair next week. Cindy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who don't know the organization, what exactly is the Collaboration Center Foundation?
We are a disability resource network and really the only of our kind in Southern Nevada. We connect those who are facing any form of disability of any age with the resources they need, whether it be assessment, insurance support, therapy support, assistance with state Medicaid, support groups, the full range.
So basically, people who have a need but aren't sure where to find all those resources, you help coordinate that.
Correct. And to really cut down on the frustration of sitting on a phone for hours and trying to connect it all together, our team does that for those individuals at absolutely no cost to them.
That's amazing. So how does a family become eligible or apply for services at the Collaboration Center?
What's wonderful is it's not really even an eligibility or an application process. It is as simple as giving us a call or contacting us through our website at www.collablv.org, filling out the information, and one of our case managers will reach out to them and get them started on the process. And we'll do an intake, sort of do an assessment of what the needs are, what the challenges are that they're facing, and then we start doing our work.
Wow, that's great. All right, so tell us about the fourth annual Harvesting Hope Family Fall Festival and Community Resource Fair.
This is really a wonderful opportunity for our entire disability to gather and come to our campus and really explore the full range of resources that are available to families. And it really, the individuals who come in terms of vendors is really quite diverse. When we started this 4 years ago, we had 20 vendors. Now we are at almost 50, which really is almost at capacity for us. And it is those who can provide therapy services. It is those who provide education services for those with disabilities. It is groups that provide social interaction opportunities, for-profits, nonprofits, social security disability attorneys, the full range.
Okay. What are some examples of those vendors that will be there?
So, for example, we have our facility partners for on campus. So we'll have Boys Town Nevada there. We will have Let's Talk Therapy Center. We will have the Let's Talk Therapy Center Preschool, which actually gears their services to those children with disabilities. Children's Heart Foundation, Welt Law, which is one of our sponsors, and they are a social security disability attorney. One Cares, which is also one of our sponsors, are just a few examples.
Nice. Okay. So besides those amazing vendors, what else is happening at the resource fair? What do you have in terms of food, music, entertainment?
A lot of fun interaction. So we will have a DJ there all afternoon playing some great music. We have the Clark County Library District who's going to be on site, and they are going to be promoting the services that they have in terms of both, you know, within their libraries and mobile services, but they're also going to be doing storybook walks with the kids. We have a cakewalk that's going to be taking place. There's going to be activities within our garden. So for some hands-on interaction, there is going to be face painting. We're going to have a petting zoo. So it is really an afternoon where the entire family can come from 12 to 3 and just have a great time on the campus in a fully safe and inclusive environment.
Nice. Okay. So what exactly is a cakewalk?
So a cakewalk, think of like musical chairs, but when the winner gets to choose a baked item.
Okay. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Now, the petting zoo, you've called it a sensory-friendly petting zoo. What does that mean exactly?
That means that really it's just, you know, animals that are obviously, I mean, all petting zoos are friendly per se, but this is really something where, you know, quiet animals, animals that are just really familiar with kids and interacting with them.
Nice. Okay.
So no roosters or peacocks or anything, you know?
And nothing with sharp teeth that bites.
Exactly. Exactly.
We won't be petting coyotes or anything.
No, we have our own resident coyote on the campus that visits us each night. So we hope he stays away. So
yeah. Okay. So you mentioned that it's 12 to 3 p.m. What day is it happening?
It is on Saturday, November 8th, so it is a week from the Saturday.
And where exactly does that take place?
It is on our campus at 8390 West Windmill Lane. It is the southwest part of the valley in between Buffalo and Durango.
Perfect. So, where can people find out more information about the Collaboration Center if they want to find out more about the services that you offer and all the things that you do on that campus, or if they want more details about the Harvesting Hope Festival? And hey, if they want to sign up to be a volunteer or for services.
Very simple, all in one location. Just go to our website, www.collablv.org.
Perfect. All right. So once again, the website for the Collaboration Center Foundation is simply collablv.org, collablv.org. You can find out all about the Collaboration Center Foundation, everything that they do, the Disability Resource Network, everything that's on that campus there in the southwest of the Valley, 8390 West Windmill Lane. And if you'd like to find out about the Harvesting Hope Festival, the fourth annual one's coming up next Saturday from 12 to 3 p.m. right there on the campus. Those details are also there at collablv.org. And if you'd like to go through the intake process, you can start that there. Or if you want to be a volunteer, make a donation, all of that's right there, collablv.org. And we've been speaking today with Cindy Gusak, Executive Director of the Collaboration Center Foundation. And Cindy, I really appreciate you being here, sharing more about what you do in the community. The Collaboration Center Foundation has just seemed to grow more and more over the years, offering more services and making more differences in people's lives. And the Harvesting Hope Family Fall Festival and Community Resource Fair is just one example of that. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the time and support.
We are the 25%. That's a quarter of all Americans, over 61 million people with a disability. And we want a world where everyone is 100% included, just like you. Easter Seals Disability Services. We are the 25.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Samantha Crow, Associate Director of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. It's been a year since the organization's Teach Kind Science program launched Kind Frog, designed by teachers for teachers. Samantha, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So for those who don't know the organization, what exactly is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA?
So PETA has been around for many, many years. We're the largest animal rights organization in the world, and we have a lot of international affiliates as well. And then Teach Kind Science is the department that I work in, and that is comprised of former science educators who are eager to help other teachers replace animal dissections in the classroom.
Okay, and what's the Teach Kind program's Kind Frog?
So the Kind Frog is a really exciting product. It is a one-to-one replacement for frog dissections. So if you have any, you know, if you had a dissection experience, you might remember, you know, the trauma or the smell or, you know, any of that. I certainly remember whenever I experienced that when I was a student. So it completely replaces the smell and the blood and guts, of course, of, you know, preserved frogs. It's a silicone frog that students actually cut into with, you know, scissors and scalpels, and they can explore the internal anatomy without killing anyone.
Yeah, that's awesome. So besides the blood, the guts, the smell, how does this compare to the old traditional method of dissection that we all did growing up?
Yeah, so, you know, support for animal dissection is really waning, and rightly so. So students can explore animal anatomy today without harming a single animal. You know, the biggest difference is that you can swap out the preserved animal for either a digital dissection. So it's an interactive computer program that has, you know, digital dissection tools and additional layering of the tissues in, you know, the animal that you're studying. You know, and then also Kind Frog is just a dissectable frog model. So there's so many ways to explore, you know, biology and science without harming anyone.
What do children and teachers think of it over the past year?
Ooh, everyone loves the Kind Frog. So students in our pilot program who dissected the kind frogs were, many told us they were relieved to learn that they wouldn't have to dissect a real frog, which I think is very telling. You know, they described the kind frog as cool and interactive. And, you know, other students were simply happy that they didn't have to violate their ethics, you know, for a grade. Of course, teachers have said that the kind frog is a game changer in the classroom. And I love to hear that.
Yeah, definitely. Now, when classrooms do still use real animals for dissection, where are those animals coming from?
Ooh, so millions of animals are killed for classroom dissection in the United States every year. So, you know, keystone species like frogs and many sea life are stolen, you know, from their homes in the wild. Piglets and other animal organs come from slaughterhouses. And then, of course, you know, cats come from shelters, and it could have been someone's lost or stolen animal companion.
Yeah, yeah. So would actually having to dissect real animals have any kind of impact on the kids, whether that's psychological or maybe even dissuading them from going into the sciences?
It absolutely does. So when you think about animal dissection, the word that comes to mind for most people recollecting their experience is trauma. And I think that's a very important word, you know, to always associate with animal dissection, because it is a very dangerous lesson to teach students that animals are nothing more than classroom tools that you can just use and discard. But it also really deters students who are compassionate and empathetic towards animals, which is most young people, frankly. It deters them from careers in science because sometimes animal dissection is used as like a gatekeeping exercise instead of, you know, having full inclusivity and just using animal-free methods where everyone feels comfortable participating.
Yeah. So you have the kind frogs, but I remember when I was in school, we did earthworms 1 year, we did rats 1 year. So what about the rats, the insects, the pigs, the cats? Do we have kind versions of those in the future?
Oh, that's a great question. It is my hope that we will have some additional kind animals coming down the line. But with our pilot program, we will donate materials to address all of those species. So the alternatives, the animal-free methods exist for earthworms and for sea stars and fetal pigs. They're not all necessarily the silicone animals, you know, that is, or like the kind frog that's brand new on the scene, but there are other methods and they have existed for a long time. And we're, you know, super excited to promote the animal-free science methods to educators.
Okay. Now, obviously, in the schools that have had the kind frogs and do have access to PETA Teach Kind Science resources, that's fantastic. What if anyone's listening who is a parent, a teacher, even a student who's thinking, you know what, we have to dissect real animals. I don't want to. What's the solution for them?
Absolutely. So listeners can learn more about our work to end animal dissection at PETA.org/dissection. Teachers, please sign up for our pilot program to get free animal-free methods at teachkind.org. And then students specifically can check out PETA2.com. That's our youth division website. And we support students navigating anything from a lack of, you know, vegan food in their cafeteria to getting out of animal dissection. So PETA2.com is the place for student support.
All right, fantastic. So once again, those websites, if you'd like to find out more about animal dissection and the kind frogs, go to PETA.org/dissection. That's PETA, stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So PETA.org/dissection. If you're a teacher and want to find out more about the Teach Kind Science program, including kind frogs, teachkind.org is the website. teachkind.org. And for students who are interested in finding out more about animal welfare, PETA2.com. That's the number two. So PETA2.com, PETA2.com. And we've been speaking today with Samantha Crowe, Associate Director of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, in the Teach Kind Science program. Samantha, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know more about the Teach Kind Science program, especially Kind Frog. Sounds like an amazing innovation for kids who need to dissect but don't want to hurt the animals, and you know, the future resources, the other types of resources that you have available sound amazing as well. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are the National Park Foundation. And together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Nithya Chambers, Emmy Award-winning storyteller and senior executive at Lonely Planet. The Global Travel Authority is revealing its top destinations and experiences for next year with the release of Lonely Planet's Best in Travel 2026. Nithya, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
So first of all, what's Lonely Planet?
Lonely Planet is a 50-year-old travel brand. You probably best know us for our Blue Spine guidebooks. We have helped generations of travelers discover the world and discover themselves in the process. Best in Travel is our annual list that really features, the places that we think travelers should think about next year.
Yeah, awesome. So tell us more about Lonely Planet's Best in Travel 2026 specifically.
Well, Lonely Planet's Best in Travel annual list is really our love letter to travel every year. We love putting it together. I always say the only thing our team loves more than traveling is helping other people decide where they should travel. This year's list features 50 places, 25 destinations, and 25 experiences. And we really try to balance once in a lifetime with maybe next weekend. I think for us, we love the high-low, the opportunity to find a place and kind of add it on to your trip, or a place that's the trip itself. So we really think about the list with that in mind so that we can speak to different kinds of travelers and the things they want to do when they're traveling.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because a lot of best places to travel list would be just the locations, but you've got those special experiences, like, for example, Premier League football game in England or the Creole Trail rides in Louisiana. Why do you feel it's important to include those aspects?
Well, I think, you know, I'm so glad you called those out. I think for us, first of all, it's how people travel, right? You want to see a certain site. You want to taste a specific dish. You want to sleep in a specific type of accommodation or have an experience when you're there. And it is how people are discovering the places that they want to go and planning trips around it. So it was really exciting for us to meet travelers in that moment. But second, I think those sensory experiences are really how you get to the soul of a place, how you can experience its culture, its history, the community and the people that live there. And so for us, like, I think for us, that's a really just exciting way to think about destinations and to help encourage people to travel, because I think it's just, it is a really a way to kind of be part of a place and to think about the kind of trip you want to have when you're there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what makes a destination worthy of being included on the list?
Well, for us, I think it is really about something that feels inspirational but accessible. And I think for us, at Lonely Planet, the opportunity to foster connection in the places that we go, to highlight places that are popular and kind of have captivated the imagination for decades and centuries, as well as places that are up and coming, places that are, you know, introducing you to a corner of the world or a part of the place that you live that you may not have thought about that way before.
Yeah, okay. What are some of the places and experiences in the U.S. that made the list?
Our U.S. list, we're super excited about this year. Definitely an outdoor bend on it. We featured Maine, I think, like the coastal culture. The food, the landscape there is really one of a kind in the United States. Theodore Roosevelt National Park in the Midwest, the Painted Canyons, the prairie, the dark sky. It is really like a kind of an unusual and special National Park. Next year, the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library is opening there. And that kind of made it a moment for the park, something unique to experience for travelers. And we, you know, we also featured a stay at Volcano's House in Hawaii. We featured wine tasting in Willamette Valley and opportunities, I think, to kind of experience local culture, local cuisine, and really plugging into a place that is sometimes not a place you might have thought of at first pass, but kind of introduces you to a nook of the United States in an unusual way.
Yeah, that's awesome. It sounds like quite the cross-section of various different experiences across the whole country that people might not have thought about before.
Yeah, and I think also an opportunity to captivate the imagination. One of my favorite picks for the United States is one of our creative director on our team last year rafted the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon, which I think is a kind of a bucket list experience to have. I know there's a lottery system, you have to go with a guide, but when she came back, she was just like a renewed person, right? Like the opportunity to really like kind of live and camp on the river. You're sort of, you know, guided by the day and off the grid in terms of like cell phones and computers. And so for us, I think, you know, there you can have like a weekend experience. You can have a once in a lifetime experience. And it's really always exciting to be able to feature both.
Yeah, for sure. Now, speaking of that, how does it actually work with visiting all these locations? It sounds like it's through the various contributing authors.
Well, it's our team. I think for us, the recommendations, it's really important to us when we make recommendations to travelers that we've been there, that the tips you're getting, the recommendations you're getting are based on a lived experience. And also on places that we went and like we just could not stop talking about. So our team has gone to the places that we recommend. We usually start a few months out and really it's a fun time of year and always a time of year that makes you super envious of the adventurous spirit and sort of travel philosophies of the people that you work with because we've gone everywhere. And we come back and we really debate and we think about what the world is going to look like next year and how we want to feature places and what travelers are looking for. And we bring this list together. So it's always just a really special moment for the whole company and an exciting time for us to serve travelers that want to travel the Lonely Planet way.
Yeah, awesome. So how does this list reflect broader travel trends in general?
I think for us, the focus on experiences in this list, right? I think and kind of stepping out of the United States for a second, you know, staying at a traditional Japanese inn, experiencing the regional cuisine of southwestern India and Kerala as a culinary tour, hiking the Victoria bathing trails in Australia, which is, you know, a 500-mile stretch that connects sea pools and hot springs and nature walks. For us, it was just an opportunity to really lean into those sensory experiences that people want to have when they travel. And oftentimes, we'll kind of pick and build a whole trip around. So for us, I think that was how it was really reflective of what the trends are, in that people are really looking for those experiences as much as they're thinking about the primary destination they want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So how can listeners find out more or see the full Best in Travel list?
Well, lonelyplanet.com is a great place to start. You can, you know, explore the entire list there. I should note that this year we launched Lonely Planet Journeys, which is a travel service. So half of our trips are bookable through Lonely Planet, which is new and exciting for us. And I think a really fun way to take dreaming to doing. And the Lonely Planet Best in Travel list we publish as a book every year, so you'll find it wherever books are sold in your local community.
Nice. Okay. So once again, the website for Lonely Planet is simply lonelyplanet.com, lonelyplanet.com. You can explore the list of the Best in Travel 2026, or you can get a copy of the book, which is a wonderful book with some great photos inside as well. All of that's there at lonelyplanet.com. And we've been speaking today with Nithya Chambers, Emmy Award-winning storyteller and senior executive at Lonely Planet. Nithya, I really appreciate you being here, highlighting these locations, these experiences, and even if people can't go to all of them, reading about them is an experience in and of themselves. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
A tree can be a warrior, battling global challenges with greater courage. A tree can be a solution, cleaning our air, supporting our communities, and protecting our wildlife. A tree can be noble, growing hope in every corner of the world. That's why now is the time for trees. Millions of trees. Join our planting movement at arborday.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Lindsay Gracia, Director of Partnerships at Operation Warm. A new survey finds that 42% of girls ages 10 to 17 skip sports if they don't have a proper sports bra, and Operation Warm's Fly Forward program is providing the solution. Lindsay, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what's Operation Warm?
So Operation Warm is a national nonprofit where we aim to gift brand new coats, shoes, and sports bras to kids in need. We work with schools and organizations and community partners to make sure families not only get the essential gear, but also access to other resources and support.
Wow, that's great. So what do the new survey results reveal about girls and gym class or sports?
Absolutely. So we know that for any young person, it's important that they stay active. The data shows us that physical activity is critical for all youth, but even more important for girls. We know that girls who are physically active report significantly fewer mental health challenges, you know, sometimes upwards of 1.5 to 2.5 times fewer mental health challenges than non-participants. And 78% of parents believe that sports are key for building self-esteem. We also know that participation in sports builds more than just physical strength. It fosters skills that are really crucial for girls' future success, such as leadership, teamwork, and discipline.
Okay. Why is it that the girls are skipping gym class or sports just because they don't have a sports bra?
Absolutely. So we're serving girls at that middle school and high school age level where girls' bodies are changing and they don't always feel comfortable or know exactly how to have the conversation around what they truly need. Through our survey results, we found that 42% of parents said that their daughters have skipped gym or physical activity because they didn't have a proper fitting sports bra. And more than half of parents said that their daughters avoided activity because they felt uncomfortable in what they were wearing. So for us, the key takeaway is that comfort and confidence really, truly directly impacts participation. So at Fly Forward, you know, it's more than just the gear. It's also about giving the girls the confidence to take their place on the field and in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of gear, why do experts say that sports bras should be considered essential sporting equipment?
Absolutely. Not just for access and participation levels, but it's also about equity, opportunity, and belonging. As I mentioned, the age range of the girls that we're serving, you know, really it's just a matter of ensuring that they feel seen and represented and that they have the access to participate. We've also talked with athletic directors who 98% of them say that a sports bra is a necessary piece of equipment to play sports. And 94% of athletic directors also said that just by receiving the sports bras and having them available made it easier to discuss the need for proper sports equipment with their female students.
So tell us more about the Fly Forward program, how it works, and how it's helping girls move with more confidence.
Absolutely. So at Fly Forward, we provide high quality sports bras to the girls who might otherwise go without or not have access to them. We partner with organizations to provide funding and also beneficiary organizations like schools or community recreation groups to ensure that we're equipping the girls with what they need to stay active. We can host gifting events with our partners and directly in those schools to help the girls get inspired through teamwork. And those are hosted by volunteers who help the girls feel seen, supported, and celebrated. And the recipients, the girls have reported feeling more confident and more interested and more likely to participate. 87% of the girls said it makes them more comfortable being active, and 98% of the girls said that sports bras is an essential piece of equipment.
How are the sports bras distributed? For example, if someone's listening and thinking, oh, that would be great at our school, how does that work?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of ways. We, like I mentioned, work with corporate partners, foundations, grants, you know, for funding opportunities, and then also for the schools or the organizations who are interested in receiving them. We have a wish list application on our website at flyforward.org. FLYFWD.org, where organizations can go on our site and help us understand the need that they have and by filling out a wishlist application.
All right, that's awesome. And, you know, the weather's getting colder, and you did mention that Operation Warm also provides coats and shoes. How does that part of the program work?
Very similarly, so on our website, operationwarm.org, there's information there on our coat and our shoe programs as well.
Okay, perfect. So once again, the website for the Fly Forward program is flyforward.org. That's spelled FLYFWD, flyforward.org. You can find out all about the Fly Forward program, which is part of what Operation Warm does. And if you'd like to find out more about Operation Warm as a whole, the website is operationwarm.org, operationwarm.org. And we've been speaking today with Lindsay Gracia, Director of Partnerships at Operation Warm. Lindsay, I really appreciate you being here. This is some really interesting data that you've shared, and it obviously affects a lot of girls and young women. And if we can start them young with that confidence and that leadership ability, this is such a wonderful thing. So thank you so much for sharing today what Fly Forward's doing.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Time out.
Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the NIAA and the Nevada Athletics Directors Association.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Brian Heilman, Senior Researcher at the Movember Research Institute. Their new Real Face of Men's Health report uncovers some urgent challenges while offering practical, evidence-based solutions. Brian, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure, Heather. Thanks for the opportunity.
So first of all, what's Movember?
Movember is actually the largest men's health focused charity in the world. We were founded about 20 years ago. If people know us, you probably know us as the organization where guys grow a mustache for the month of November to raise money and raise awareness of men's health issues. But we've also founded this new research institute, and that's where I work and where this report comes from.
Awesome. Okay. So the new report says that men's health is a family and a community issue, not just a men's issue. Why is that an important distinction?
Well, right. I mean, all of our health affects our loved ones and our family members and friends, right? Like, we're all interconnected in that way. We found in this report that 53% of men in the United States are dying under the age of 75, which is kind of an international marker for what's called premature mortality. So truly, the majority of men in the United States die prematurely. And when you think about that, in isolation, it just feels like a statistic. But when you think about it as your grandfather, your father, your friend, your brother, it becomes, you know, years of connection and rich stories and family life lost. And that's why we feel the issue is so urgent.
Yeah. So why are men in the U.S. dying younger than men in other countries?
It's a complicated one, right? And, you know, we live in a big country with a complex population, and there are a lot of intersecting challenges to address this or any other social or public health issue. But when you look at the sheer stats of it, and we see that men in the United States are dying about 6 years younger than men in other wealthy countries, you start to realize, like, wow, there is something about what's happening here. This is not just a biological factor, and we need to pay urgent attention to it.
Yeah, for sure. So men's health is typically seen as a personal issue, but your report also shows an economic impact. What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, sometimes, you know, putting it into the dollars and cents helps it resonate home for people. And so we did analyze for only the five leading causes of men's premature mortality. We added up the combined toll of the hospital costs, insurance costs, and also the lost productivity that comes from somebody dying young. And it's just a staggering number. It's $420 billion only from these five leading causes. So you can imagine if we were to add in every single possible cause of premature mortality. And to bring that home for people, we analyzed and found that it's the equivalent of about 1,500 hospitals' annual operating expenses. So just to think, if we were to actually have access to that money that's lost by men's early death, we could run 30 new hospitals in every state in the United States. And so that just helps show the magnitude.
Yeah, definitely. So what typically prevents men from seeking health care?
Yeah, it's a complex range of factors. And in fact, in our report, we kind of find that men are less indifferent to their health than maybe the stereotype might suggest. 95% of men felt that looking after your health is a sign of self-respect. And we did a survey of men who had seen the doctor in the prior year. And out of those men, 70% of them said that they went to the doctor completely of their own accord. They didn't need to be prodded or pushed by a family member. So we have to also break down some of these stereotypes. I think guys do care about their health. They just, you know, they're struggling with maybe difficulty of accessing high quality healthcare. Or when they do seek out, the doctor only has a couple minutes for them and there's no chance to really talk about the wider things going on in their lives. And they're also still continue to be influenced by this looming notion of, you know, be a man up, the kind of like rigid ideas of how men are supposed to be. And when you really talk to individual guys, they don't quite that often agree with those ideas themselves. They're just aware of them looming in society.
Okay. So it sounds like that is changing. What can we do to change it further?
Well, that's what Movember is here to do. We think it's important to just have the conversations, right? So check in on family members you love, guys, yourselves, you know, feel free to seek out Movember.com. Learn about our campaign that we do every month of November, download and access the report. We also have so many useful tools on our website that would guide you in having a conversation with someone who's maybe having a hard time. And, you know, just do what you need to do to look after yourself.
So typically when people think of men's health, they're thinking physical health, but mental health and loneliness are also covered in the report. What's the outlook there?
Yeah, I mean, we're having a real moment of like a loneliness crisis in our country. And that applies, according to the statistics, to men as well as women. It's not only a men's issue that we have by moving a lot of our lives online, the lasting impacts of COVID and lockdown. We just live more isolated lives and it leads to people feeling lonely. The distinction with men is that men are a lot less likely than to seek support or reach out to someone or have someone close in their life they can turn to just talk through that and work through the challenges of loneliness. We found that in 1990, way back 35 years ago, there was a survey that asked men how many close friends they have, and only 3% of guys, so very, very few guys, said that they had no close friends. Today, that number is 15%. So you're close to about 1 in 8 guys who say that they don't have any close friends. And that's, you know, something that we should be concerned about.
Yeah, for sure. So Movember is about action, and you've given several tips, but what's that one thing that listeners can do to support men's health for Movember?
Yeah, I would say visit our website again, Movember.com. You can read the report. It's a massive report with a lot of interesting information in there. And I know I've shared a lot of dour statistics, but the report is also full up of stories of people providing care for men, finding richness in the connection that comes from doing that. Community-based programs all across the country that are building mental health skills and resilience in young men. And plenty of even state-level government leaders who are trying to take action on this. So there's certainly a lot of positives as well.
That's awesome. All right. So once again, the website for Movember is Movember.com. That's Movember with an M as in mother, Movember.com. You can find out more about the movement, about the nonprofit. You can read the report, The Real Face of Men's Health 2025 United States Report. Download it right there. Read it, all the details. As Brian mentioned, we have positives and negatives there. And you can read it all at Movember.com. And of course, for the month of November, men, go ahead and grow that mustache to continue to raise awareness for men's health. And we've been speaking today with Brian Heilman, senior researcher at the Movember Research Institute. And Brian, I really appreciate you being here, shining a spotlight on men's health and revealing what you found in the report, a lot of interesting information and a lot of great tips that you've provided for men and the people who love the men. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heather.
Cancer screening can save your life. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
Daylight saving time for this year ends this weekend. I'm Dennis Foley with Odyssey News. We have Stanford health professor Jamie Zeitzer joining the show. He did a study on the impacts of daylight saving time. So what'd you learn?
Well, there have been several studies, many studies, that have looked at the fall back and spring forward time points. And what they've generally shown is not much of an effect on the fall back, but in the spring forward, where we both move one time zone and lose an hour of sleep, that's associated with negative health effects, notably increase in heart attacks and in motor vehicle crashes. Now, the effects are quite small at the individual level, but when you have 350 million Americans on the same day losing an hour of sleep, you start seeing these effects, these impacts. And you can kind of think of it like a lottery ticket. You know, if you've got 350 million people playing the lottery on one day, someone's going to win. This is just not a lottery that you want to win.
So let's talk about some of the impacts. You know, you talk a little bit about car crashes. I guess you could say a lot of it may be motor skill related, whether it's just lack of sleep. But are there other impacts, you know, like, you know, disease aspects of things?
Well, frankly, at the transition points, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, so you're basically looking at what's happening in the week before and the week after to see if there are these kinds of changes. And frankly, you know, with those changes, the effects, again, are going to be quite small in the sense that if you think about it, every week, many, many people will lose an hour of sleep, gain an hour of sleep on any given day. They'll change their sleep timing. Young people in their 20s and 30s routinely move their sleep timing 3 or 4 hours every weekend. So when you're looking at the system, you know, we are specifically interested in what's happening in the circadian system, which is this 24-hour clock that's in your brain. You've got this central clock in your brain, and it helps to basically anticipate lots of changes in your environment. So it helps anticipate when you're supposed to sleep and when you're supposed to eat and when you're supposed to exercise, or at least when you're regularly doing that and when the body should anticipate that and get ready for it. And you'll experience this, you know, most abruptly when you travel across time zones. So if you travel across time zones and you move like 6 or 7 hours, then your circadian system is very much not telling you to do what behaviorally you want to do. It'll tell you to sleep when you want to be awake. It'll tell you to eat when you don't want to. But then you adjust to it. So this is a big change. And what happens during daylight saving is kind of a small change. These transitions are much smaller. When you have day changes and you do them all the time or routinely, so when you take a look at people who do things like shift work or have routine travel schedules, like you see this in airline personnel, then what you see is that people will get sick more often. There's more cancer in these individuals. They'll have just the common cold more often. There's often increased rates of depression. There's increased rates of metabolic disorders. There's all sorts of problems that you get when you have it chronically. You really don't see that kind of short term. But one of the things that's interested us and that we've published recently on is what happens if you change time policies so that we're permanently in either standard time we're permanently in daylight saving time. What would happen then when it's an everyday thing? When every day, according to time policy now, light is going to be a little earlier or light is going to be a little later. And again, we're not changing with time policy. We're not changing how much light there is. We're just changing, relatively speaking, when it's occurring within your day. And as opposed to just twice a year, you have this kind of dramatic one-hour shift. I'm not even sure if it's that dramatic, but you have a one-hour shift. Instead, it's just every day. What kind of impact would that have? And what kind of impact would that have on your health? And when you look at that, at least over the course of a year, you see lots of small adjustments being made from a day-to-day basis. And what you can see is that when you're in permanent standard time, that's actually better for your overall health and specifically for strokes and obesity than being in permanent daylight time. And both of them, by the way, are better than doing this biannual shifting.
So what's the benefit of the permanence? Is it more of you're not doing the shift? Is it more of our bodies just know how, I don't know an easier way to say it than it just, you know, your body knows when the sun rises and sets, and
right.
It already has a natural metronome, if you will, to that clock.
Sure. So the permanence kind of gets at two different points. One is that there's no longer the twice yearly change, which in general people hate. Now, frankly, from a physiologic perspective, the twice yearly changes for most people aren't a big deal. Again, it's something that routinely we do to ourselves. We lose and gain hours of sleep on many, many nights. But especially in the spring, people can point back to it and say, ah, the reason I'm tired is because of this spring forward and I lost an hour of sleep and now I'm miserable because I lost that hour of sleep. Even though in the past few weeks, you've lost hours of sleep many nights. But this is something that we can point to. It's someone else's fault because they put in this time policy. So there's that one aspect, is that people don't like this change. And the other is that people have very strong opinions about whether they would rather have that extra hour of light in the morning or in the evening. And this is something which is both, you know, something which is related to personal preference and is related to health. Now, personal preference, there's nothing to do. It's just some people like it in the morning, some people like it in the afternoon. And many times this has to do with how your life is structured and organized. So do you like it in the morning because you like to go for a run in the morning? Or do you like the hour of light in the morning because you bike to school? Do you like the hour of light in the afternoon because you want to go play golf or tennis after work? So there's a lot of reasons why people would like that light. Some people hate going to work in the dark. Some people hate coming home from work in the dark. So there's a lot that goes on there. And frankly, it changes quite a bit based on not only who you are and what your preferences are, but also where you're living, both north and south. You know, so if you're further north, then the amount of light that you're getting every day is different than if you're living further south. So what might be, say, beneficial or preferred in Montana and Maine and Washington are not necessarily what are preferred in Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. It also matters where you are in the time zone. So if you're further east than the time zone, you're already getting more light in the morning than people who are further west. So if you're in the eastern part of the time zone, sunrise is going to be an hour earlier than it is on the western part of the time zone. So all of these things kind of matter and kind of contribute to how people view this kind of time change. And, you know, as you point out, having this kind of permanent thing is pretty good. But even now, you're talking about months, you know, depending on how the U.S. in particular splits it up. It's not usually 6 months in one, 6 months in another, but it's still many months in each different time policy. So in either daylight time or standard time. And your body definitely adjusts to it. It adjusts to it, frankly, after just a couple of days. So I don't think it's really that aspect of it, but people definitely do have this personal preference and often very strong personal preferences to when they would prefer that light to be.
And I would say in the U.S., you know, yes, most of the country does do the switch back and forth, but, and I'm sure that you all didn't, you know, you couldn't go into this granular detail, but you look at a state like Arizona that doesn't do the switch back and forth, in a way, it's kind of like you have a control compared to the rest of the country. Is there any way to kind of know that a lot of these risks or hazards that switching to and from daylight saving time and also just daylight saving time in general, is there a compare and contrast that you all can actually just be like, yeah, you know, Arizona sees these trends that are different than these other states like Utah or Nevada?
Right. No, it's a great point. We wish we had data from Arizona before and after it decided not to do daylight time anymore. We don't have access to that data. We actually did look at the county level, though. So we looked at every individual county in the lower 48. So Hawaii also, as well as Arizona, doesn't follow the daylight saving time switch. They just stay in permanent standard time. But when you look at the county level, you do see some of these trends. In essence, yes, Arizona acts as kind of a control, but we did include it in our calculations as that. But we didn't see anything particularly unique about what's happening in Arizona. But we also didn't expect to, just given the structure of the data. This is something that, again, if we look before and after they decided to do the switch, that would be kind of an important type of a thing to look at. But those data were not available to us. Yeah, so anyway, it's something that it's important to look at. Again, we couldn't look at the individual level, which would be amazing, but we could look at the county level. And the county level becomes important because it's dependent on what are the health conditions in that county? How many people live in that county? So as the counties are stretched out across the United States, they definitely do not have the same size and density of population, nor do they have the same health problems. And so it's important to account for that when looking at, you know, what time policy might work best for the nation as a whole.
One final thing before I let you go. Looking at all this data, living life, I mean, you experience time like everyone else does. You experienced the time changes and everything. What would you take away from the study, the data? What would be your kind of three main bullet points from what you've learned in all of this?
So for me, I would say that we need to have a conversation that's based on data. It's what kind of motivated me to do this study in the first place, was that from the biomedical perspective and the sleep and circadian perspective, much of this was based, much of the conversation, and there are pieces put out by various medical groups supporting permanent standard time, but it was based on theory more than on data. And that bothers me. And it bothers me that the conversations that we have as a country when it comes to time policy are often based on personal lived experience and anecdotes and not based on data. So to me, I hope this stimulates people to provide data in their areas of expertise. Because I can tell you there will be no single time policy that makes everybody happy. The question is that what time policy would, in my perspective, make the most people healthiest? That is my perspective. Other people may have a different perspective. They may want the time policy that, you know, makes the country the wealthiest. They may want the time policy that gets people exercising the most, though. I think that kind of feeds into the health component. But I do think that we do need to generate more data so that we can have a reasonable conversation about what is the best. And then, as you point out, how to mitigate the problems that it causes. Because as I said, no matter which time policy we use, permanent standard time, permanent daylight time, our current biannual shifting, or something in between or even different, no matter what we choose, there's going to be problems. There's going to be people who are frankly harmed by it, whose health is going to be less good, whose welfare is going to be less good. And so the question is, what can we do to mitigate those with whatever time policy we choose? And so I view this more as a starting piece of the puzzle rather than an end. I wish that the data were so conclusive and so overwhelming that it just said, this is the only time policy that we can choose because it is so beneficial to human health. But it's not. It's an effect. It's real. It's a small effect to any individual, but it is a larger effect when you're looking at the health of the nation as a whole.
That's Stanford Health Professor Jamie Zeitzer. I'm Dennis Foley with Odyssey News.
We got a higher home appraisal after we put away our African art and family photos.
Has this happened to you because of race or national origin? Contact HUD at hud.gov/fairhousing. A message from HUD and the National Fair Housing Alliance.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, November 3rd at 8 p.m. benefiting the Nevada Acro Foundation, and Monday, November 17th at 8 p.m. benefiting Sing Out for Autism. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. Living Grace Homes is holding their annual Glitter, Glamour, and Grace Runway Luncheon featuring fashions by Anne Fontaine next Friday, November 7th from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Ahern Luxury Boutique Hotel on West Sahara Avenue. Proceeds go towards providing safe shelter and support to pregnant young women and mothers facing homelessness. Get your tickets or find out more at livinggracehomes.org. That's livinggracehomes.org. Silver State Equality is holding its annual Silver State Equality Awards ceremony on Wednesday, November 12th at 6 p.m. at Chaos Nightclub inside the Palms Casino Resort. The awards celebrate Nevada's LGBTQ plus achievements and honor inspirational leaders. This year's honorees include TV personality and humanitarian Lisa Vanderpump and former Las Vegas City Mayor Jan Jones Blackhurst. Get your tickets or find out more at silverstateequality.org. That's silverstateequality.org. And Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada is holding their annual Thanksgiving turkey drive to feed local families, and you can help by dropping off frozen turkeys and non-perishable Thanksgiving meal items up until Thanksgiving at their campus, 1501 North Las Vegas Boulevard, south of Owens, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. You can also make an online donation with every $25 providing a full Thanksgiving meal for a family. Find out more, donate, or sign up to volunteer at CatholicCharities.com. That's CatholicCharities.com.